The next day, Michael drove out to visit Solomon Dooley at Drake's farm. He wanted to have his views on the Rage article and tell him of the consequences he had suffered at Marshall Square. That was not necessary. Solomon and Dooley somehow knew every detail of his detention and interrogation, and Michael found he was a celebrity at the offices of Assegai magazine. Nearly every one of the black journalists and magazine staff wanted to shake his hand and congratulate him on the article. As soon as they were alone in his office, Solomon told him excitedly, "Nelson Mandela has read your piece, and he wants to meet you. But he's with the police. He's on the run." "After what you wrote, he trusts you," Solomon said. "And so does Robert Sobukwe. He also wants to see you again." Then he noticed Michael's expression, and the excitement went out of him as he asked quietly, "Unless you think it's too dangerous for you." Michael hesitated only a moment. "No, of course not. I want to meet them both. Very much." Solomon and Dooley said nothing. He simply reached across the desk and clasped Michael's shoulder. It was strange what a pleasurable sensation that grip gave Michael. The first comradely gesture he had ever received from a black man. Shaza banked the HS-125 twin-engine jet to give himself a better view of the Silver River mine 1,000 feet below. The headgear was of modern design, not the traditional scaffolding of steel girders with the great steel wheels of the haulage exposed. It was instead a graceful, unbroken tower of concrete, tall as a 10-story building, and around it the other buildings of the mine complex, the crushing works and uranium extraction plant, and the gold refinery, had been laid out with equal aesthetic consideration. The administration block was surrounded by green lawns and flowering gardens, and beyond that there were an 18-hole golf course, a cricket pitch, and a rugby field for the white miners. An Olympic-sized swimming pool adjoined the mine club and single quarters. On the opposite side of the property stood the compound for the black mine workers. Here again, Schauser had ordered that the traditional rows of barracks be replaced by neat cottages for the senior black staff, and the bachelor quarters were spacious and pleasant, more like motels than institutions to house and feed the 5,000 tribesmen who had been recruited from as far afield as Nyasaland in the north and Portuguese Mozambique in the east. There were also soccer fields and cinemas and a shopping complex for the black employees, and between the buildings were green lawns and trees. The Silver River was a wet mine, and each day millions of gallons of water were pumped out of the deep workings, and these were used to beautify the property. Shaza had reason to be proud. Although the main shaft had intersected the gold-bearing reef at great depth, more than a mile below the surface, still the ore was so rich that it could be brought to the surface for enormous profit. What's more, the price could not be pegged at $35 per ounce for much longer. Shaza was convinced that it would double, and even treble. "Our guardian angel," Shaza smiled to himself as he levelled the wings of the HS-125 and began his preparations for the landing. Of all the blessings that have been heaped upon this land, gold is the greatest. It has stood us through the bad times and made the good times glorious. It is our treasure and more. For when all else fails, when our enemies and the fates conspire to bring us down, gold glows with its bright particular lustre to protect us. A guardian angel indeed. Although the company pilot in the right-hand seat watched critically, for Shaza had only converted to jets within the last 12 months, Shaza brought the swift machine into the long blue tarmac strip with casual ease. The HS-125 was painted in silver and blue, with the stylized diamond logo on the fuselage, just as the old Mosquito had been. It was a magnificent machine. With its seating for 8 passengers and its blazing speed, it was infinitely more practical than the Mosquito. But Shaza still occasionally mourned her loss. He had flown over 5,000 hours in the old Mosquito before at last donating her to the Air Force Museum, where, restored to her combat camouflage and armaments, she was one of the prime exhibits. Shaza rolled the glistening new jet down to the hangar at the far end of the strip, and reception committee was out to meet him, headed by the general manager of the silver mine, all of them holding their ears against the shrill wail of the engines. The general manager shook Shaz's hand and said immediately, "Your son asked me to apologize that he wasn't able to meet you, Mr. Courtney. He's underground at the moment, but asked me to tell you he'll come up to the guest house as soon as he gets off shift." The general manager, emboldened by Shaz's smile of paternal approval, risked a pleasantry. "It must run in the family, but it's difficult to get the little blighter to stop working. We almost have to tie him down." There were two guest houses, one for other important visitors to the mine, and this one set aside exclusively for Shaza and Santan. It was so sybaritic, and had cost so much, that embarrassing questions had been put to Shaza at the annual general meeting of the company by a group of dissident shareholders. Shaza was totally unrepentant. "How can I work properly if I'm not allowed at least some basic comforts? A roof over my head. Is that too much to ask?" The guest house had its own squash court and heated indoor pool, cinema, conference room, kitchens and wine cellar. The design was by one of Frank Lloyd Wright's most brilliant pupils, and Hicks had come out from London to do the interior. It housed the overflow of Shaz's art collection and Persian carpets from Velta Frieden, and the mature trees in the landscape garden had been selected from all over the country to be replanted here. Shaza felt very much at home in this little pied-à-terre. The underground engineer and the chief electrical engineer were already waiting in the conference room, and Shaza went straight in and was at work within 10 minutes of landing the jet. By 8 o'clock that evening, he had exhausted his engineers, and he let them go. Gary was waiting next door in Shaza's private study, filling in the time, playing with the computer terminal. But he leapt up as Shaza walked in. "Dad, I'm so glad I found you. I've been trying to catch up with you for days. I'm running out of time." He was stuttering again. These days he only did that when he was wildly overexcited. "Slow down, Gary, slow down. Take a deep breath," Shaza advised him. But the words kept tumbling out, and Gary seized his father's hand and led him to the computer to illustrate what he was trying to put across. "You know what Nana has always said, and what you were always telling me about land being the only lasting asset? Well..." Gary's powerful spatulate fingers rippled over the computer keys. Shaza watched with curiosity as Gary presented his case. But when he realized what the boy was driving at, he quickly lost interest and concentration. However, he listened to it all before he asked quietly, "So you've paid for the option with your own money?" "I have it signed here," Gary brandished the document. "It cost me all my savings, over £2,000, just for a one-week option."
"Let me recap then," Shaza suggested. "You have spent £2,000 to acquire a one-week option on a section of agricultural ground on the northern outskirts of Johannesburg, which you intend to develop as a residential township, complete with a shopping complex, theatres, cinemas and all the trimmings.
There's at least £20 million of profit in the development, at the very least." Gary manipulated the computer keyboard and pointed to the rippling green figures. "Just look at that, Dad."
"Gary, Gary," Shaza sighed. "I think you've just lost your £2,000, but the experience will be worth it in the long run. Of course there is a £20 million profit in it. Everybody knows that, and everybody wants a piece of that action. It's just for that reason that there is such strict control on township development. It takes at least 5 years to get government approval for a new township, and there are hundreds of pitfalls along the way. It's a highly complex and specialised field of investment, and the outlay is enormous, millions of pounds at risk. Don't you see, Gary? Your piece of land is probably not the best available. There will be a dozen other projects ahead of yours, and township development just isn't one of the areas which we deal in." Shaza broke off and stared at his son. Gary was flapping his hands and stuttering so badly that Shaza had to warn him again.
"Big breath," Gary gasped, and his barrel chest expanded until his shirt buttons strained. It came out clearly.
"I already have approval," he said. "That takes years, I've explained." Shaza was brusque. He began to rise.
"Oh, we should change for dinner. Come on."
"Dad, Dad, you don't understand," Gary insisted. "Approval has already been granted."
Shaza sat down slowly. "What did you say?" he asked quietly.
"Township approval was granted in 1891 by the Volksraad of the old Transvaal Republic. It was signed by President Kruger himself. But it is still perfectly legal and binding. It was just forgotten, that's all."
"I don't believe it,"
Shaza shook his head. How on earth did you get onto this, Gary? I was reading a couple of old books about the early days of the Witwatersrand and the gold mines. I thought that if I was going to learn mining, the very least I could do was bone up on the history of the industry, Gary explained. And in one of the books, there was a mention of one of the old Rand lords and his grandiose idea of building a paradise city for the very rich, away from the coarse and rowdy centre of Johannesburg. The author mentioned that he had actually bought a 6,000-acre farm and had it surveyed, and that approval had been granted by the Volksrat. And then the whole idea had been abandoned. What did you do then? I went to the archives and I looked up the proceedings of the Volksrat for the years 1889 to 1891, and there it was. The approval. Then I researched the title deeds of the property at the deeds registry and went out to the farm itself. It's called Buffiansfontein, and it's owned by two brothers, both in their 70s. Nice old fellows. We got on well, and they showed me their horses and cattle and invited me to lunch. They thought the option was a big joke, but when I showed them my £2,000, they had never seen so much money in one pile in their lives. Gary grinned. Here are copies of the title deeds and the original township approval. Gary handed them to his father, and Shaza read through slowly, even moving his lips, like a semi-literate, so as to savour every word of the ancient documents. When does your option expire? He asked at last, without looking up. Noon on Thursday. We'll have to act fast. Did you take out the option in the name of Courtney Mining? Shaza asked. No, in my own name, but of course I did it for you and the company. You thought this out alone, Shaza said carefully. You researched it yourself, dug up the original approval, negotiated the option with the owners, paid for it with 2,000 of your own hard-earned cash. You did all the work and took all the risks, and now you want to hand it over to someone else. That isn't very bright, is it? I don't want to hand it over to just anybody. To you, Dad. Everything I do is for you, you know that. Well, that changes as of now, said Shaza briskly. I will personally lend you the 200,000 purchase price, and we will fly up to Johannesburg first thing tomorrow to clinch the deal. Once you own the land, Courtney Mining will begin negotiating with you the terms of a joint venture to develop it. The negotiations started tough. And then, as Gary got his first taste of blood, they grew tougher. My God, I've sired a monster, Shaza complained, to hide his pride in his offspring's bargaining technique. Come on, son, leave something in it for us. To mollify his father a little, Gary announced a change in the name of the property. In future, it would be known as Shazaville. When they at last signed the final agreement, Shaza opened a bottle of champagne and said, "Congratulations, my boy." That approbation was worth more to Gary than all the townships and every grain of gold on the Witwatersrand.